Okay, fine. All right. Hi, Andrew. How are you? We're gonna start in like 2 minutes. Okay, 1 minute, we'll start the 7:58. We still have a few more minutes. Daron, how Daron, how you
I'm doing okay. How are you?
doing? Okay. And Ezra, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you, Rabbi Berman. How about you?
Baruch Hashem, where are you, Ezra?
I made it back to Monaco, thankfully. I was afraid of getting stuck in London, so I flew back to Monaco this past week.
And how are things in Monaco?
It's pretty much like in France, but yeah, at least I can spend Pesach with my family and not on my own.
So things are a little bit rough there, I guess.
I mean, they're rough everywhere. I don't know if they're rougher in France than they are in Israel or in England. They say England is 1 week behind, so they'll be in the same place as we are next week. The measures are slightly stricter here. At least in France they are. And but people get along. You as long as you have a as long as you have a routine and you manage to structure your day, you can just about keep sane. How
Fair
about in
enough.
Israel?
I understand that. We've been cooped up for a couple of weeks now. But we're doing okay. We have a yard, so that's a huge thing. So we get to get out a little bit. We've really mostly been in the house for 2.5 weeks or something like that. The past two Shabbatot were okay. The previous Shabbat was very difficult. That was right before it started, and we just weren't sure what was going to happen and whatnot. But I think it's okay. Here, 1 second, I'll be right back, and then we'll start this year. It's just complicated. My family's having dinner, so the that's how it has to be. John, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Wait, where are you now?
I am still in Binghamton,
Oh, okay.
relatively untouched by coronavirus. Busy, busy.
School's open?
Virtual classes.
Okay. And they kept it in the dormitory though. That's kind of wild.
They are highly incentivizing people to move out.
I hear that. It makes sense. Okay. Let's see who else is. What happened there? Not that it matters. Joseph, how are you?
Rabbi, how's it going?
Okay. How are things? You're home?
Yep.
How's everything at home? Everybody okay there?
Yeah, so far, thank God.
New York's getting a little rough, so okay. Let's see if I can move it up. Okay, so we'll start. Everybody sees the screen, I assume. Hey Adam, how are you? I'm gonna try and move this down so I can see the screen. Okay, let me. Okay. No. Okay. Okay, we're gonna start. What I'm going to do is try and give an overview of the structure of the Haggadah as understood by Rav Huttner in Pachad Yitzchak 17. It's one of my favorite Pachad Yitzchaks. the real issue he's going to start out with is the centrality of questions being a theme in the Haggadah. And we'll see that there's going to be an overlap between both the structure on the one side and the content on the other, which is going to give us, I think, a nice, on the one hand, overview of the structure of the Haggadah, but even more so, in Rav Huttner-esque fashion, it's going to give us a chance to see a very deep concept, which really he's going to understand and permeate all of Judaism. Okay, so we're going to begin. Let me see if I got that guy there. Okay, so the first Mishnah, the first few Mishnayot in the 10th Perek of Pesachim, as we know, the 10th Perek of Pesachim deals with the Seder. The whole Masechet of Pesach Pesachim deals with building up towards the 10th Perek. The first four chapters deal with kind of preludes to Pesach, dealing with matzah, chametz, things like that. There are five chapters in the middle dealing with the korban. My son and I actually, for his bar mitzvah last year, so we learned all of Masechet Pesachim. So Masechet Pesachim by the Rishonim is often broken down into the first four chapters with matzah, chametz, and the last chapter dealing with the Seder, and the middle section dealing with the korban. We're going to jump to the 10th chapter of the Mishnah. I highly recommend anyone who really wants to understand Pesach or understand the Seder better can look at the Mishnah and see kind of the early development of the Seder. But we're going to jump right in. So the first few Mishnayot talk about that bringing Kiddush wine, etc. I just have to explain something about the meal. In Roman times, when they ate, when wealthy people ate, they ate in a place, in a room in their house called a triclinium, where there would be three beds, and each bed, several people would be on each bed to eat, three people or so, and in each bed would have its own little table. Basically, it's a table, like a pillar, or some holder to hold the table, and then a tabletop on top of it. If you go to the old city and you go to the Cardo or some of the excavations, that area, you can see some of the old houses from Bicini that have that type of table situation. If you go to Ben Yehuda Street, you can even see they sell platters, these huge round platters that Arabs still use for their meals, or some people do use for their meals. In this fashion. So the way it worked was, it wasn't like our tables where you had a table and I just ate dinner with my kids. You have a table and bring all the food out to the table. Or I remember when I was in South Africa, the food might be in the other room and you bring it from the other room, but you all sit down at a table. In the time of fancy meals and by Cheney, each course was brought out on a different platter. So the whole platter was a tabletop, and the slaves would bring out the platter with, let's say, the wine course, and you'd order the appetizer course, and you'd have appetizers. They'd pick up the platter, take it out, bring in another platter. So the first platter they bring in is the platter of wine, and people would say kiddush, and then they would bring out time for washing their hands. They would eat karpas, or some sort of salad course. And then, of course, the next thing to do is they bring out the bread. And that's where we're up to, bring out the bread course. So that's in Mishnah, in number one there, Mishnah Pesachim, Mishnah Gimel. They would bring out the salad course and the person would dip. Until they had a salad course before their meal, until the bread came out. Now the bread course would be an entire platter full of the matzah. And what would be on that platter? Hevilfanav matzah, the bread, v'chazeret, and a type of bitter herbs, v'charoset, v'shnei tavshilin, and two cooked things. There's a little caveat in the Mishnah here I'm not so interested in about whether or not a charoset's a mitzvah or not. But after that discussion, it says, v'mikdash hayu mevin lefanav gufo shel pesach. The time of the Beit HaMikdash, if you're in your slime, so you would have the korban as well. So basically what you have is the meal. So you have to imagine they brought a whole platter of food, including the bread, and now we're going to say a motzi. So if it was a regular holiday, like Shabbat, you said Kiddush, wash your hands, the next thing would be hamotzi. But instead, they had to pick up the platter, take the platter out, and bring in a wine course again, and that's Mishnah Dalet. Mazlo kosheni v'kana ben shoel aviv. And we change it around so that the son, says the Mishnah, would then ask, I understand, we're about to eat, why are you taking that away and bringing out another wine course? That's abnormal. And here's a central facet, and I highlighted Shoel. The Mishnah continues, if the child doesn't know how to ask, then it's obligatory for the father to teach him how to ask questions. And what are those questions? And we know the Manishtana. So first the son has to ask the Manishtana, and if he doesn't know, we have to teach him to ask those questions. And we do all kinds of wild things at the Seder to make the kids ask. And the Mishnah continues, that Mishnah there in Dalet, Lafi dato shel ben aviv lamdo. According to the aptitude of the child, the father teaches him. And then the next part after the question, Marchil beginut mesayim b'shevach. The discussion of the evening has to be one that begins in disgrace and concludes in praise. V'doresh marmiya v'ravi. And thirdly, we have Manishtana number one. Number two, you have to have discussion from disgrace to praise. And number three, we have to discuss the section in the Torah in Devarim dealing with the bringing of the Bikurim. And why that is, we'll hopefully explicate as this goes on. But that kind of is the outline of the Seder. What I focus on, it's the Seder is really strange. It's especially strange, the fact that it has to be Shoel. There's no issue. It can't be that the father teaches the son, here, this is what you do. God took me out of Egypt. You don't do that. It has to be questions and answers. And let's continue to number two. When the Gemara discusses this, look at the emphasis the Gemara gives on it. Tanu Rabbanan. We have a braita. Chacham, but no, if the child is wise enough, Sholo, the child asks. If they don't have a child, the child's not sharp enough, the wife has to ask the questions. Vim lav hushua. And if not, the person leading the Seder, there's an assumption that there is one person leading the Seder, the owner of the house, he has to ask the questions. Lots mo to himself. So a person this year, especially with the horror that's going around, I'm actually going to give a shir on a less source-based shir on Wednesday night at 11 p.m. our time in Israel on how to run a Seder. There are tons of people who are running Sedarim for the first time, some of them by themselves, like one person, and this is applicable. It's hard to imagine. It's just so out of the ordinary and so difficult. What do I do? What do I do? So no matter what one does, the Mishnah said, the Braita says, you have to ask questions. It's not sufficient to say, let me just read a text. The text has to begin with questions. Even two Tony Chachamim who know the lachas, they have to ask questions. So the Gemara paralleling the Mishnah brings up number one, it has to be a question answer form. That's the order of the night. Number two, like the Mishnah said, that we begin with disgrace, we begin with praise. Now, if you compare this to, let's say, the one of the more famous, it's funny, those of you who are in the yeshiva, one time Professor William Kohlbrenner spoke at Eretz Tzvi, and he asked the question, he said that, T.S. Eliot once suggested that the first epic of Western literature was the Aeneid. And Professor Kohlbrenner didn't understand why the Aeneid was the first epic of Western literature and not the Homeric epics like the Iliad and the Odyssey. I would like to suggest, as the Iliad and the Odyssey were oral, I wrote this to him, he didn't like it, but I think I'm right. Okay, we could disagree. But the difference between the Iliad and the Odyssey versus the Aeneid is the Aeneid was actually written. It actually is written literature. That's how it was designed. Saul Lieberman has a famous discussion about the canonization of the Mishnah, and he uses the Aeneid as one of the examples. In any event, if we compare to the Aeneid, the great epic of the founding of Rome, so it goes all the way back to Troy, and Romulus and Remus are descendants on one side from Aeneas, who's a descendant of Priam from the king of Troy. Other side, they're of gods and of priestesses, and every which way, they had the perfect genes. That's not true in the story, our story. Our story starts Beginai with disgrace. Now, what is that disgrace? We have a machloket between Rav and Shmuel on the definition of disgrace. Seemingly, Aramiya Vedavi, the next part, is not sufficiently disgraceful or not disgraceful. But look what they say. The number two in the middle section there. My beginut. What is a disgrace? That we're going to end up with praise. Rav Amar Matchil Ovdei Avodah Gilim Hayu Avotenu. Rav says that our ancestors were idol worshippers. Ushmuel Amar Avadim Hayinu, that our ancestors were slaves. Now, dealing with Mitzrayim, obviously the slavery aspect is what comes immediately to mind. And indeed, we know, those of you realize, we do both. The main section of the Haggadah is like four pieces. The piece number one, we mentioned Avadim Hayinu. After the Manish Tana opening it up, we do Avadim Hayinu as a story of the Jewish people. We also do that our ancestors were pagans, Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu, and we continue with Aramiya Vedavi and those drashot, and then we end up with a praise section. But in any event, both Shmuel and Rav's positions are accepted. In the Haggadah, we talk about slavery, and we talk about spirituality. So Shmuel seems to be focusing on the day. The night is supposed to commemorate freedom from physical bondage, and Rav suggested it's freedom from spiritual bondage. From spiritual bondage, we eventually found God. From physical bondage, we eventually were free. Now, we have a little story in the Gemara, which is an important story. I'm going to watch the time. It's a long, sure, we're going to go fast, but we're going to hit some major league notions, ideas here, concepts here. But let's just see this one, which is, highlights that it's not about a text, but about a method. It's not about the text of the Haggadah, but the questions. So that's the last part in the Gemara there, number two. Amalei Rav Nachman Ladaro Avdei. So Rav Nachman had a servant, he had a slave, his name was Daro. Okay. Avda, that was a slave. He says to his slave, sorry. Avda demafik le mare lecherut. A slave whose master sends him forth, Mapik is to send forth, sends his slave forth to freedom, frees him. Furthermore, he gives him silver and gold. My boy, so Rav Nachman said, what should this slave say to his former master after the master frees him, gives him stuff, etc.? There's that. I remember Rabbi Jadis Schachter, in one of the first editions of the first volume of the Torah Umada Journal, discusses the curriculum that, or one of them, discusses the curriculum that that Rav Dessler's father suggested he read. His Rav Dessler's father, Rav Dessler, the author of the Michtam Eliyahu, one of the great Bali Musar. So his father gave him a post-Holocaust Bali Musar. His father gave him various books of literature, and one of the books he suggested that he read was Uncle Tom's Cabin. So I read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Rabbi Schachter said he doesn't understand why that was suggested. I think anyone who reads Uncle Tom's Cabin, I certainly felt it was obvious. It's a very spiritual book. In Uncle Tom's Cabin, there's one point where he's really expecting his slave owner to free him. And the slave owner, unfortunately, promised him, in fact, he's going to free him. And the slave owner then dies, and the wife feels she can't free him for whatever reason. But the anticipation, whenever I think of this Mishnah or this piece of the Gemara, I remember that Uncle Tom's Cabin, that anticipation of the slave going free and then going free, what's his response? His response would be, says the slave, he needs to thank him, and to praise him. Amarles Rav Nachman says, and this is the point, Patartan Milomar Manishtana. You've exempted us from the need to say Manishtana. So Manishtana is a requirement, not because it's the text, but because it's the idea that you have to ask the question, what should we do tonight? What should be the response of the Jewish people to the great things that God did for us when we started out as slaves and eventually we'll conclude. Now, Professor Tabori, that's Rabbi Tabori of Eretz Tzvi's uncle, who spoke in the yeshiva a number of times, Professor Joseph Tabori of Bar-Ilan University, in his Haggadah, and he also said, I think, in the yeshiva as well, he suggested that if you look, originally it would seem that the Manishtana was probably three questions. The three questions are about the Korban Pesach, one's about matzah, and one's about maror. That was probably the original questions. That's more or less how they appear in the Mishnah. If that's the case, that's like one bookend, and the end of the Haggadah is Rabbi Gamliel say, Misha lo amar, shosat varim elu, lo yatzai dei chavatov, eluhen pesach matzah maror. And the answer to the questions of Manishtana come at the end of the Seder, where Gamliel says you have to discuss Pesach, Matzah, Maror, and what they're all about. So the entire Seder begins, as it were, with one bookend of the questions and goes through to the answers at the very end. Why we do these symbolic foods. Symbolic foods represent the freedom, the bitterness, the freedom, and God's providence to Am Yisrael. So that's the order of the Seder. It has to be a question and with an answer, and question and with an answer, and then again praises, etc. And we're going to discuss why this is. Number three, I just mentioned that some of the things that we do today have precursors to keep the kids awake. Now look what number three says: Amar Alav Rabbi Kiva Shaya Mecha Klayot Gozim. In the times of the Mishnah, they didn't have, you know, I don't know. Today, my Seder, I don't know what your Seder is, they do, but in my Seder, we give the kids candy when they answer questions, keeps them up, they're all excited, a big candy bowl in the middle of the, I don't feel we've ever really got it right, because we just have, every time they ask a question, they put candy in the bowl, but they get the candy anyway by the time Pesach's over, because we have the bags of candy, we're not going to, like, you know, lose them. It's kind of a funny thing. But in any event, the candy gets them all excited. And Rabbi Kiva used to do that. He used to give out parched grains and nuts, which is basically candy of the time of the Mishnah time. Filatinoko, Bear of Pesach. We give them out before the Seder, I guess. Kadesh Shalo Yishanu V'Yishalu. So the kids won't go to sleep and they'll ask questions. Get the kids to ask questions. And number four, I just mentioned the Rambam points out questions. Look how many times he points it out. Like four or five times, questions appear in that one halacha. Okay. Now, in order to understand this, we need to take a couple steps back and understand what is the content of the Seder? And that's elucidated by the Maharal. So the Maharal says, why do we start Beganut Masayim B'Shevach? Why is the Seder have to be on that pattern, whether it be slavery, physical slavery, whether it be theological slavery, being pagans to the true belief in monotheism? So the Maharal says the following. B'kasher tavin od teda od. You'll know further if you understand the following fact. K'ashevach shekodom lo gnut yoter shevach. Praise, which comes after disgrace, is greater. It's unlike Rhymus and Remus. Of course they were going to found Rome. I mean, they had all the genes, right? Big deal. It doesn't say very much. But the fact that we would start out as slaves and a slave people could become free, or people who were lost spiritually and religiously could eventually find a religious home in monotheism, understanding God, the true God, Akash Baruch Hu, that is significant. It's that movement from Sheva, from Ganut, disgrace, to Shevach. Now the Maharal adds a wonderful line here. Kamo shetireh ki hayom kodem lo halayla. Just like the day precedes the night. The night precedes the day. There's darkness and there's light. And why is this? V'zemine ki hashlemut. John, I can see your face. Just nod if you can see the little hand. Is your little hand there? Yofi. Okay. Zimine ki ashlemut eno nimtza. Perfection. Shlemut means perfection. Perfection. action is not found behind Klatobla Mazet at its outset in this world. In other words, we're in a world of imperfection, and therefore anything in this world starts out imperfectly and has to move towards its goal. That's very Aristotelian of the Maharal, talking about teleology, but the idea is that you're moving towards something. You're moving from imperfection to perfection. And then he goes on to talk about how it's a divine level, etc. But the world was set up, the world's spinning. We're all on this planet, and the planet spins. And as the planet spins, according to the Torah, we have to look at night, vayhi erev, vayhi boker. Night precedes the day. Night precedes the day. Why? Because the light of day will be greater once it's preceded by night. The praise that comes after disgrace is greater praise. So not only is it the content of the Gada, but in a certain sense, the Maharal is suggesting it's the fabric of creation. The way God's of creation is in the same manner. And we're going to come back to that in a few minutes. We're going to take a slight digression. Those of you who learned from Huttner know his digressions. We're going to take a slight digression to a basic notion of theology that Huttner sees as fundamental. And that appears in the Shari Tshuva by Rabbeinu Yonah, number 6. So we're going to keep remembering in the back of our heads, the question we have the night is why questions. We know that the structure of the Gada is disgrace into praise. The Maharal compares that to darkness precedes the daytime, the light. And now I want to look at something from a slightly theological tefillah perspective, number 6. And that is the Shari Tshuva by Rabbeinu Yonah, the great Spanish posek in Musar Rishon. Number 6. V'yesh lo botech b'shem lo chil ma'ov tzukato. A person who trusts in God, when is he supposed to begin his hope? His hope in God begins ma'ov tzukato, kind of at the end of his depth where he's fallen into a great cliff. Ki achoshech siba ha'ora. And we're going to have to explain this in a minute. For the darkness will be the cause of the light. Kamosha katuv, as the pasuk says, the Navi says in Micha, Al tisamchi oy vatili, my enemies don't be happy with me, ki nefalti kamti, for I have fallen, I will rise, ki yesheb choshech Hashem orli, for when I sit in darkness, God will be my light. Vamru rabbeinu zichron levracha, and Chazal say about this, what does it mean when I dwell in darkness, God will be my light? Ilmalei nefalti, had I not fallen, lo kamti, I would not arise, ilmalei yeshav choshech, Lo haya or li. If I hadn't dwelled in darkness, God would not be my light. Now, what does that mean? So there's another pasuk which is very commonly quoted by Hasidim. Rav Huttner loves this pasuk as well. He's going to explain it the same way I once heard years and years and years ago from Dr. Norman Lamb. He gave a speech and he quoted this pasuk and he gave the exact same explanation Huner's going to give in the name of Tzadik Kohen. I asked where it was. I couldn't find it exactly, the passage he referred to, but I believe him that it's in Tzadik as well. And that's number 7. Mishle, Shlomo Melech says, Kishevi pol Tzadik v'kam. The Tzadik will fall 7 times and he will arise. Rashayim yikashlu b'ra'ah. But evildoers will just stumble in their evil. Now, kishevi pol tzadik v'kam, 7 times tzadik and he will arise, might be understood as the greatness is to get back up. You know, when you have a kid, when you're training a kid to walk, so they fall and you hope they get back up. You fall off the horse, you get back up. You fall off the bike, you get back up. And that's like perseverance. I can get back up despite the fact I fell. Huttner says that's not pshat, and then Tzadik also agrees with him. Again, in that pasuk, number 7, kishevi pol tzadik, as a tzadik falls 7 times, vikam, and he will rise. The nature of the rising back up is dependent on the falling. Again, with the kid, if anyone has ever taught a kid to walk, I don't know if I'm the only one here who's done that, but anyone who has ever taught a kid to walk or ride a bike, and teaching a kid to walk is more fun than teaching a kid to ride a bike, trust me. But if you teach a kid to walk, they need to fall. If you catch them every time, they won't understand how to gain balance. So it's the falling which becomes part of the rising up. They can only walk because they fell. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, it's only because I dwelled in darkness that I can really see the light of God. Right? My enemies don't be happy with me. Kinafalti kamti. The quality of my rising is only because I fell. So again, the darkness ends up being necessary for the light. Gnut, disgrace, is required for greater shevach. And if we look at the history of the Jewish people, the moment when the Jewish people, in a certain sense, started our journey, it's fascinating. That's number 9. If we were to think for a second, who started it all? Who was the one who started the journey? That's Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu, at the end of Parshas Noach, we know that Avraham Avinu is on his way to Eretz Canaan, but they leave Ur Kasdim, they get stuck in Haran, and Kadosh Baruch Hu, the next Parshas, Parshas Lech Lecha, tells Avraham Avinu to go. But if one were going to say, listen, if you want to go somewhere, you want to go to Yerushalayim, so I'll tell you, or, you know, you want to go somewhere and good, you say, you know, Rabbi Berman, where would be good to go? And I'll say, oh, it would be great if you went to go see the Kotel. And let me tell you how to get there. But look what God does in number 9. V'yomer Hashem el Avram. Now, he's only Avram at this point, right? He hasn't turned to Avram yet. Lechacha me'artzacha v'latzacha me'beit avicha. Leave your land, leave your father's, your birthplace, your father's house, and go el ha'eretz asher ereka, to the land I tell you. This is Zoom events are a little new for me, right? So one of the issues is having a live audience is you can always see the reactions and ask questions or whatever. So I'm just going to pretend that I'm asking, and we'll get the responses. But what is missing there is the location. God said, go to land, I tell you. And what's so significant of it is not only is that that's true, God doesn't tell Avraham Avinu where he's going, but if we look a little further, Avraham Avinu, when he recounts it, makes a big deal about that. Later on, when he recounts his experience to Avimelech, he says the following, number 10, V'hi kasher hitu oti Elohim, when God hitu oti, confused me. He didn't say when God sent me, took me, led me. He says, confused me. Mebet avi, v'omer la, and said it's me, his chesed, etc. But Amavinu feels that it was quintessential to his experience that there was some aspect of not knowing where he's going, of requiring Amavinu when God says to him, go to where I tell you. So Amavinu's first thing is, where is that? Where are we going? The Ramban talks about that. The Ibn Ezra talks about that. They emphasize this aspect of Avraham Avinu. But I want to go a little further and just point out that the beginning of Am Yisrael is a search of being lost. We don't know where we're going. We just know that we're going towards God. We just don't know where that is. Now, in the next part, part 3 of the Magid section of really the stories, again, the first one is Avadim Hayinu, Shmuel's understanding of Gnut. And then the next section is Rav's understanding of Gnut, Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayavotenu. Then we get to the section of Bikurim, those verses from Dvarim, where we start to explicate the story as it's spelled out, in a very like synopsis form in Dvarim. And that's number 12. And some people ask, why in the world do we have this? One might think if the goal of Seder Night is to discuss the story of the Exodus from Egypt, so where's the obvious place to go? Shemot, the Exodus of Egypt. Why Dvarim? Why the story of the Bikurim? One of the reasons might be is it is a case, or the case, the quintessential case, where Akash Baruch Hu spelled out how you're supposed to remember the Exodus from Egypt, an actual text, a formula. You'll notice there's a lot of fours floating around, and we ended up reading four psukim as well. Also, I don't have the pasuk here, but the previous pasuk, I think pasuk Gimel, if I'm not mistaken, refers this as Haggadah. That uses that term, just calling this little summary of the story as Haggadah. But all those, all those are important pieces to it. But I want to go actually into the text. So what are you supposed to do in Bikurim when you're really bringing the first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash? on Shavuot. So you go and you bring a basket of fruit to the Kohen, you give it to the Kohen and say, here, Kohen, here's the fruit, and you give a testimony. And this is the testimony, the story of the Exodus. Vanita v'amarta l'fnei Hashem l'kecha, and you will recite in front of God, Arami Oved Avi, that my father was this. Now Rashi's following, Rashi and the Rashbam, his grandson, disagree on Pshat, Arami Oved Avi. If you open up the Maxwell House Haggadah, I believe they seem to follow both Rashi and Rashbam in its interpretation. Let's skip to Rashbam first. We'll go to Rashi. What does Arami Oved Avi mean? Now, the critical word might be Oved. Oved is a verb. It's a strange verb. Now, is Oved a transitive verb or an intransitive verb? Is Oved meaning like emphasizing the Arami just intransitively with no object? Or is it takes an object and that's Avi? So let's look at the Rashbam first, number 14. Arami Oved Avi, who is Arami? Avraham Arami Haya. Avram was an Aramean. Oved, intransitive. It means lost. He was lost. The Golem Eretz Edom. And he was lost in coming from Eretz Edom. He was kicked out. He was totally lost. And that's what we refer to. Avram Avinu as our ancestor who left Ur Kasdim, left Haran and was lost and was wandering around till God found him and brought him to Eretz Yisrael. And then he went to Mitzrayim, etc. Or as Rashi understands it, as a transitive verb, Arami Oved Avi, that the Arami went to Oved at Avi. So it's an object, it's a transitive verb which requires an object. The object is Avi. Maskir chastei ha-makom Arami Oved Avi lava mikesh la-korat ha-kol. Here, Rashi quotes the Haggadah Shel Pesach. The Arami here is Lavan, and the Avi here is Yaakov, that Lavan tried to kill Yaakov, and then he ended up going to Mitzrayim. But number 14, in the way the Rashi understands it, and the way Maxwell's Haggadah does, I think, in the main text, the translation, my father was a wandering Arami, my father was lost, is exactly the point. Abavina, the very beginning of Klal Yisrael, was lost, and this we put in the Haggadah. That Avraham Avinu was lost, or alternatively, again, it was Yaakov Avinu who was being chased. Now, to understand this issue of being lost and found, I want to look at one of my favorite pieces in all of the Gemara. Before we get there, let me give a quick summary. So we said our real overarching question is why is the Gada formulated in question and answer form? We then talked about this idea that the order of the Seder, the text of the Seder, has to follow Gnut to Shevach, disgrace to praise. We said the Maharal suggested that's like light looks better after darkness. The dawn is always brighter after a dark night. We discussed the fact that Avraham Avinu at the very beginning was lost, and that was seemed to be essential to his religious experience. And indeed, in the Haggadah, when we come to a text, we discuss possibly, at least the way one interpretation is, that that's the focus of Avraham Avinu being lost and then searching around for God. So now I want to go into this famous, one of the more famous Gemaras, physical Gemaras, and that is about the baby inside the womb. It's a Gemara. The Gemara needed describes the baby, and many people know this from the time they're young. It's a famous story that inside the womb. Again, if you're all audience in front of me, I was going to do some. I suggested to my kids that I do it at dinner time, in front of them as a live audience, but they all rejected it. And one of my daughters said, "I heard you. I gave this morning so the Australians could hear it at 8 a.m. Israel time. So it was 4 in the afternoon in Australia. And one of my daughters said, you know, Ab, I heard the second half that." Hear it again. Okay, fine. But what I would do is I would say, so what happens is we all know the angel teaches the baby inside the womb, the Torah. And then what happens? He gets this little thing, right? The angel, before the baby comes out of the mother, the angel gives him a whack on the mouth and he forgets all the Torah. What is it talking about? I mean, like this is just seemingly very out, very weird, but it's actually quite the whole Midrash exploration is quite beautiful. We'll just do a little piece of it and then focus in and focus out. So number 15, the story of the baby, the fetus inside the mother's womb. Darash Rabbi Simlai. So Rabbi Simlai gave the following drasha. L'mav lad domet. To what can a fetus inside the mother be compared? Meimo. L'pinkas mekupal umunach yadav al shtei tzidav. It's like, he's like a pinkas. A pinkas is a notebook. It's like a folded up notebook, unwritten on. In other words, he's a tabula rasa. He hasn't been written on yet. And he's just waiting to be opened up. You take the book and you open it up when he comes out. But it's right now it's closed. And stay kavav, I'll stay, and it's squished up like in a fetal position. Roshonach. Lo bein berkav, and look at the highlighted section here. Upiv satum, his mouth is closed. V'tiburo patuach, his umbilical cord is open. His belly button is open to the umbilical cord. Vochel mash yimo chelet, v'shotem mash yimo shota. He eats whatever his mother eats. He drinks whatever his mother drinks. The baby inside the mother is in this nice little compact thing with all perfect quality control. Let's skip down a little bit about the Torah part. Mulamdin oto kol Torah kula, and teaches them the entire Torah. Became unto Bala Virolam ba malach v'tzitro al piv, and when he comes to be born, the angel smacks him on the mouth. Mishachko kol Torah kula, and he forgets all the Torah. The question I always bother with: why? Wouldn't it be better if we didn't have to do Daf Yomi, but we knew Shas already? Like, even the Torah is a symbol of all knowledge, right? It's like this Faustian type of thing. Wouldn't it be better if we knew it all already? Why in the world is it taught and then it's erased? So, well, I think what the Chazal are describing here, and this is based on the Maharal in number 16, is the baby inside the mother is in a perfect state of equilibrium. For the baby's standpoint, he is bishlemut. He's perfect. Remember that Maharal we discussed from a different place? Maharal is an extremely consistent thinker. So he says the baby inside the mother is in perfection, shlemut. Now, when he comes out into the world, our world is a world which lacks perfection, lacks shlemut. It's a world of imperfection. It's exactly what it is. So the Torah represents being perfect, one with God. And what happens is when you're brought into this world, and this is a very profound idea of the Maharal, if the baby left the mother and felt the way it did inside the mother, food was given to it, drink was given to it, quality control, everything, oxygen was given through the blood of the mother, the baby, when he comes out, wouldn't breathe. Why? Because the first breath is the child saying, I need to fill my lungs. I have a feeling of imperfection, I have a feeling of need. The first time the baby suckles milk from his mother's breast is when I need something. And without that feeling of need, if the child felt like totally perfect, then what would happen? No breathing, no eating, the child would die. Because the human being in this world, there's only one type of human being who's not growing, who's not needs something and needs to fill that thing up. And that person is the dead. The dead are no longer growing. But as long as we're in this world of imperfection, what we need to do is we need to continue to grow. We need to search. We need to feel a need and search to fill that need up. In number 17, I discussed, the Tanya also discusses this idea about man going from stage to stage. But I want to take, and just do a quick recap, the whole experience, which is being emphasized by the Gadol Shel Pesach, is the fact that we start with needs and we change towards something better. The whole experience of coming close to God is one of lack, of searching and trying to find God, always moving, trying to find God, moving higher and higher. I want to look at in number 18 here, well, let me just take a second back. We'll look at this graph. If we look at what we discussed so far, we end up seeing is, what is a question? A question is, I don't know. It's a lack of knowledge. And when you start with a lack of knowledge, you hunt for to fill yourself up for that knowledge. Just like the person who is enslaved who dreams of freedom, or the person who has incorrect ideas and realizes he's looking for something, like the Melech and the Kuzari, who gets that dream that, that your intent is good, but your actions are not good, realizing that I need something more. And that's the same thing as darkness. Darkness is a lack of the light. The question is a lack of the answer. I'm searching for the truth. Amravino's experience is lost and then found. Within the pagan worldview, you open up Aristotle. Aristotle is very a fascinating thinker in many ways. And one of the issues with Aristotle, I took a class when I was at Columbia, so you could take classes at Barnard. So I took a class at Barnard with a professor. He retired a couple years ago, but he's a famous professor at Barnard named Dennis Dalton. And Dennis Dalton taught political theory, and we were doing political theory of Aristotle. And as we started the class in political theory, one of the students raised her hand and said, "Professor Dalton," and he said, "Yes. Do you think it's correct or morally right or the appropriate thing to do to study a thinker who disparages 50% of the world's population?" Now, what did she mean by that? Aristotle was a proto, you know, you could say he was a scientist, certainly a proto-scientist. He actually was very into ocean, you know, oceanography and ocean animals and studying things like that. And the way he looked at the world was the way things are is the way they're supposed to be. So in other words, in his day, blacks were slaves. And that's all he could imagine they could be there for. Therefore, it must be something in their telos, in their eventual, you know, their goal is to be slaves. Women are subjugated. They don't rule. And because they don't rule, it must be they're not supposed to be rulers. Unlike Plato, who at least entertained perhaps not the highest of the high echelon, maybe not the philosopher king, at least he imagined they could be in the kind of the government layer below that. Aristotle thought that women should be subjugated. Why? Because they are subjugated in the Greek world that he lived in. Why is that? So Aristotle had this idea the way things are is the way things are supposed to be. And that fit really, even though he wasn't such, you know, didn't fit in the classic vision we have of paganism. But in the pagan worldview, by and large, there's this notion, Marsiliade, in fact, wrote a whole book. The name of the book is The Myth of the Eternal Return. This idea that life is a cycle. We're stuck in a cycle. And we always repeat that cycle. Aliade, has a lot of other things to say about it. But primarily, the world is stuck. And wherever you are, that's what you're going to be. And you can't break this cycle. You're stuck in it forever. So therefore, it makes sense that Romulus and Remus are the ones who become kings because it was in their genes. If they were slaves and it was part of their genes to be slaves, they could never become kings. What the Torah was coming to do, the revolution of the Torah, was to say that no, just because you're in Galut doesn't mean you can't get to Gula. Just because you're in a state of disgrace doesn't mean that you can't go to Shevach. Slave, you can become free. Or idolatrous, you can change your ideas. You can change who you are. And by the way, we have a term for that. And the term for that is called tshuva. Tshuva is coming closer to God. It's really saying, I'm stuck where I am right now. Let me break those shackles and move forward spiritually. Now I want to go back to one little coda to the discussion of the Gada, and then we'll wrap it up. We just read at the end of Sefer Shemot, and it's apropos for Vayikra, but we read at the end of Sefer Shemot the pieces, the various vessels and components of the Mishkan. When the quintessential or the quintessential component of the Mishkan, the heart of hearts of the Mishkan, was the Aron. And now all the pieces of the Mishkan, if we take, I remember I was at Gush, I think, and Menachem Leibtag, Rabbi Menachem Leibtag asked, how did they carry the menorah in the meat bar. And it's actually in the psukim, but just like, I think a lot of us just run over real fast. He said, it was in a big bag. They put the menorah in a bag. The bag had holes on top and they put a pole through it. And they carried it that way. The shulchan, where the lech lepanim were, where the bread was, how they carried it, they had poles, put it in and they carried it. The mizbeach hazahav, the little mizbeach, also poles, they carried it. When it's stationary, you take the poles out. But the Aron was different. And the Aron had within it the Luchot. It had the Ten Commandments. And it also had some of the man, a few other things as well. It becomes a centerpiece. And on top of the Aron is this golden lid called the Kaparet. On top of the Kaparet are the Kruvim. Right, and Akash Baruch Hu Shechina is supposed to dwell within that area when the Kohen Gadol goes in on Yom Kippur. Now, look at what the Psukim say. Number 18, Vasita Vasita Bade Atzei Shitim Vatzipita Tam Zahav, and you'll make golden poles, wood centers, gold coating, so that you can carry the Aron. Vaveitet Abadim B'Tabaot Al Tzalot Haron. And you'll put the poles into the rings that are on the sides of our own. Blessed are our own. And why? To carry the Aron Behem. Because you're going to carry the Aron with the poles. So the poles are so you can carry the Aron Kodesh. But then there's this strange pasuk. But Tabat Aron Yiyu Abadim, in the rings of the Aron, the poles shall rest. Lo Yosru Menu, but you'll never take them out. There was the mitzvah not to remove the poles. Now that's odd. Now one of the things about the Aron, when it eventually settled in the temple in the Beit HaMikdash and Beit Rishon, it was stationary in the Kodesh Kodeshim. It's in the Holy of Holies. It's right there. And on Yom Kippur, when the Kohen Gadol comes in, so as it were, Kodesh Baruch was manifest inside the Kodesh Kodeshim, right? We don't need poles. You're not carrying it anywhere. So what are the poles for? Not only that, when someone came to the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur to watch the avoda of the Kohen Gadol, the Aron with its poles was too big for the space of the Holy of Holies for the Kodesh Kodeshim. So the poles kind of poked out of the parochet of the curtain. So you would see the poles slightly protruding outside the parochet. So clearly when people came, part of the goal was so they would see that the Aron has poles. But why? Now, the goal here is that people come to the Kodesh Kodeshim, they come to Beit HaMikdash and Yom Kippur, they come to go have a relationship with God. And what's the symbol here? That the Aron, which is kind of the gateway towards the Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Aron, which represents us trying to get to God, always has the poles. Why? Because it's always moving. You can never finally get there. No matter where you are, as much of a sinner as you are, as much as a person you're imperfect as you are, you're always moving towards God. If you think you're super perfect, you're still only moving there. You haven't reached God. The poles are the Aron, you, as it were, carrying the Aron to get towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The whole Pesach Seder, again, is built on this idea of questions and answers. The question is galut. In other words, the question is a form of the content, which is the galut. And it requires what? An answer, which is redemption. That's the way the Pesach Seder is designed. That is the way the Avraham Avinu started, the Jewish people were designed. That's the way the world was designed, Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker, that there is always light is greater when it comes after darkness. And that is the way our spiritual lives are designed. The goal of the Pesach Seder, which is the ultimate expression of us inculcating to every generation our connection to God, is you can never completely get there. Wherever you are, that might be why, by the way, there's Arabanim in the Haggadah, because everyone's on a journey. The piece I skipped in the Tanya, the Tanya just mentioned the definition of the human being, according to Tanya, is a person who is a journeyman, a melech, a person who's on a road. So the whole life is always on this road. It's all just like, by the way, also it's described in regards to the Mizbeach, the great altar outside, there was a ramp that the Kohen Gadol would go on. And it has to be a ramp and not stairs. And stairs, wherever you are, you can stop. But a ramp, if you stop at a ramp, either you roll down or you go forward. That's your choice. And that's the same idea of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. It was a radical declaration against paganism. You're not stuck. You're not stuck where you are, but rather there's redemption. I guess we could end with a bracha. Right now, the world is in unfathomable tumult. I'm sure I share this with many people who imagine that we would be in this situation where doctors have to search for a cure, but you find the cure because you know you need to search for it. Hopefully we should all have a bracha that the medical community with Yad Hashem should be able to find a cure quickly. People should stay healthy. And just like there was a Galut of Mitzrayim that led to a Gula, which eventually made us to Eretz Yisrael, medically there should be we're in Galut now, but hopefully medically there'll be a Gula. We'll all find a remedy. The medical establishment, all those wonderful doctors and nurses and scientists and research people. I saw Rutgers is graduating their doctors early or something in order they can go to research. They should all be matzliach and we should find ourselves to finally escape this macha. Just like Yitzhak Mitzrayim should be a symbol for that. That indeed we don't have to be stuck in this sickness. We can actually move out of this sickness into a healthier world from the Galut to the Gula. We're in a Gnut right now, but hopefully we'll move towards a Shevach. The Rav famously said that the definition of dignity, dignified man, was a person who finds cures to ailments. That when you are stuck in a hospital and you can't do anything when you're sick, if you can't build a hospital, in fact, if you're sick, that's undignified existence. The dignified existence is defeating nature and finding the cure. And that's kind of the Yad Hashem. That's what God always wants us to do all the way from the time of creation. Thank you for listening in. I don't know what people do at the end of these events, but it was a lot of fun. Hey, Oliver. Hey, all I can see everyone there's like, I don't know how to use this thing so well yet. Trying to jump around. I'm happy everyone could, I see that I'm on there. Arana, hi. Isaac, hello. Hello, everybody, both the United States, Binghamton, Brooklyn and London and wherever you are. I hope you have a wonderful Pesach. I want to add the following, just as a little addendum before we end. If anybody ever feels that they need to talk to anyone, like you're going crazy, please, 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 if you want to speak to anyone in the yeshiva, it can be me, it can be anyone else, 24/7, just send us a line. I don't sleep much anymore, in which case I usually check my phone for emergencies. It's just, I don't know, people who are sleeping, but I certainly can't sleep. 24/7. If you want someone to talk to and say, Rabbi, I just want to vent, I'm going nuts. Or you want to talk about anything else. I know there are several people who have people close to them who are not doing well. We're here all the time and I'm here all the time. Any kashrut questions, Pesach questions, Seder questions, or just Stam, you want to talk. We're happy to do that. And everybody have a wonderful Pesach. Goodbye.
Thank
everybody.
You.
Okay. I guess I close out now. Stop the share. Okay.